All right, so today we're starting a new teaching, but it's actually an old teaching. It's time to redo Well Done, Good and Trustworthy Servant. Okay? I think I want to title it a little bit differently. I want to call it The Good and Trustworthy Servant. The Good and Trustworthy Servant, okay? What does that look like? What is he talking about? And how can you be one, okay? What's the expectation there? The Good and Trustworthy Servant. So this is part one. Now, I know you're going to be surprised that what was a three-part teaching, part one may take more than three parts, just warning up front, than what we did the first time. And the reason is this. Now that we've been going through a lot of this stuff for the last, say, 12 years, okay? And I've also, I guess, evolved to whatever degree in my feeling free to give you much more context, much more a fullness of understanding of a topic where, I mean, I could have hit this and just hit the very clear, short points and done it in one part like I did the first time. But I think that, think of it like going from a 101 class to a 201 class in college or a 301 or some other advanced class. We're really going to kind of break things down a little more, dig into it a little bit deeper. Now, believe it or not, we're going to be using pretty much the same verses that I used in the first teaching, but with a whole lot more verses around those verses to make sure we get the context of what's going on. And I think it's going to be very powerful for you. And I know a lot of people think, well, why can't you just make the points and then go quickly? Because you're going to miss the point. Okay, I want you to really get the point. And so we're going to be covering a lot more. So because that's a lot more verses to read, I really have no idea, as always, how long this is going to go through. So we're going to start here in part one, in the launching point, which is Matthew 25 and in verse 21. Okay? So I'm going to give us, often enough, I'll read the verse that's sort of the launching point, and then we'll go read the other verses in the same chapter that's going to give us the context. So we're going to start here in verse 21. And his master said to him, well done, good and trustworthy servant. You were trustworthy over a little. I shall set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And we see that again in verse 23. He says the same thing, right? Well done, good and trustworthy servant. You were trustworthy over a little. I shall set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. Okay, so what I intend to do is to break down in this teaching, as we did the last time, to a certain degree, the idea of what is good, because this is a servant that is told he is good. Now, of course, I really should start it with the word done, because it's well done, good and trustworthy servant. So let's just leave it to the simplicity of the servant did something. Okay? And I think that's very obvious in the end. In what's happening? The servant had something. I gave you little, and you were trustworthy in little, and so I'm going to give you much because of what you did with the little. And then we're going to talk about what was done and that it was good. Okay? And then we're going to talk about trustworthy. And then we're going to talk about what it means to be a servant. So in this first several parts, we're going to be dealing with focusing on what did they do that was good? Doing good. Okay, that's the critical piece here. Now, so the Greek word that's translated here, good, which means good in any sense of the word, so it's just a very, very much exactly what you would think it would be. So Webster kind of gives us the idea that it's having the proper qualities is something that's good. Beneficial, valid or real, and honorable. Like being a good person, sometimes we think of it as being someone who's honorable, okay? So I want to have that sort of framework as part of how we might have understood good, but what is Scripture talking about? So for the context here, let's go to actually verse 1 of chapter 25. So we're going to start there. I'm going to read most of this chapter, so it may take a little bit. So the reign of the heavens shall be compared to. So let's just stop right there and understand what's the context here. So Yeshua is speaking. He's speaking to who? He's out there speaking to a bunch of people, right? And he wants us to know the context is I'm talking to you about the kingdom. I want you to understand the kingdom and what it's like. And then also the expectations when it starts talking about people in that place, there's a lot of metaphors like the servant to be told, enter into that kingdom, enter into the joy. So here he says, the kingdom of heaven shall be compared to 10 maidens who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. And 5 of them were wise and 5 foolish. Those who were foolish, having taken their lamps, took no oil with them, but the wise took oil in their containers with their lamps. Now, while the bridegroom took time, they all slumbered and slept. So I guess our metaphor for us, I think, is universally understood that this is what we're dealing with right now. Do we have oil in our lamps or not? And we may fall asleep because we're waiting for Yeshua to show up and waiting for it. So we get complacent. So it's not that we actually fall asleep, but we're actually like sleepwalking to some degree. We're just kind of going through the motions and we're not really paying attention. And he says, and at midnight, a cry was heard. See, the bridegroom is coming. Go out to meet him. Then all those maidens rose up and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, give us of your oil because our lamps are going out. And the wise answered, saying, no, indeed, there would not be enough for us and you. Instead, go to those who sell and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast, and the door was shut. Now, I know a lot comes into this idea of, let me continue because it'll get there. And later the other maidens also came saying, Master, Master, open up for us. And he answered saying, truly I say to you, I don't know you. Watch therefore, because you do not know the day nor the hour in which the Son of Adam is coming. So for you to read this parable, we'll call it, right? Just by itself, you could really get yourself in all kinds of interesting places. But it's written continuing. There's more to this. He wants to say that, you know, he finishes that parable and immediately goes, watch therefore, because you do not know the hour in which the Son of Adam is coming, for it is like. So he's continuing. So now it's like this. And then it's like this. I'm saying you guys are missing the point. So we can't guess, as often is happening, you know, well, the virgins clearly did. It was the Holy Spirit they were talking about that they didn't have. What was this oil that they didn't have? Well, let's continue reading to see the context. He says, it's like a man going from home who called to his servants and delivered his possessions to them. And to one he gave 5 talents, and to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his own ability, and went from home. And he who had received 5 talents went and worked with them and made another 5. In the same way, he who had with 2 also gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 went away and dug in the ground and hid the silver of his master. And after a long time, the master of those servants came. So talent is a measure of silver, okay? So after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled the accounts with them. And he who had received 5 talents came and brought 5 other talents, saying, Master, you delivered me 5. See, I've gained 5 more. And his master said, well done, good and trustworthy servant. You were trustworthy over a little. I gave you 5. I shall set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. Then he who received 2 came and master, he said, Master, you delivered me 2 and I've gained 2 more. I know I'm not reading it exactly word for word here, because some of you are wondering, mine reads a little different, speeding things up a little. Verse 23, his master said to him, well done, good and trustworthy servant. You were trustworthy a little, enter the joy. Okay, so the same thing he said in 21. And the one who received the 1 talent also came and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you had not sown and gathering where you had not scattered seed, and being afraid, I went and hid your talent in the ground, seeing you have what is yours. And his master answering said to him, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered. Then you should have put my silver with the bankers at the least here, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to him who possesses 10 talents. For to everyone who possesses, more shall be given, and he shall have overflowingly. But from him who does not possess, even that which he possesses shall be taken away. And throw the worthless servant out in the outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Oh, okay. So we're getting a little bit more of an understanding that whatever was going on with the virgins is similar to what's happening here with the talents. So we can start to get a picture, I hope you're starting to see, that what they did is what filled the lamp, okay? It wasn't something that you could actually buy, really. In other words, did you actually go and do the work? The guy took 5 and he did something with it to make 5 more. Took 2 and did something with it to get 2 more. So whatever this is picturing, the kingdom is about what the Father gives us. What do you do with it? That's why it's well done. good and trustworthy servant. What are you doing with these things, right? Now, that being said, we're starting to get this picture. Now, let's continue. I want to get more of the picture, then we'll break it down. He says, when the son of Adam comes in his esteem, we're back now in verse 31, and all the set-apart messengers with him, then he shall sit on his throne. And all the nations shall be gathered before him, and he shall separate them from one another, as a shepherd separates the sheep and the goats, or the virgins with oil and the ones without oil. You see, this is all picturing the same thing. So you start having to compare. How do you compare? Okay, so the oil was the one with the two that got two and the five that got five. The one without oil was the one who did nothing. Then we see now sheep and goats. So let's see what separates the sheep and the goats. He says, and he shall set the sheep on his right and the goats on his left, and the sovereign, the king, shall say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my father, inherit the kingdom prepared to you from the foundation of the world. Okay, so the ones on the right, the sheep, are told that they are blessed of the father and they're going to come inherit. So what makes them blessed? What's the difference of the sheep versus the goats? He says it now. For I was hungry. He's going to say, this is why I'm doing this. I was hungry and you gave me food. Oh, they did something. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. Naked and you clothed me. Sick and you visited me. In prison and you came to me. Then the righteous shall answer him saying, Master, when? So these are the ones who are, you know, it's funny. They're getting all this blessing and they want to know, when did we do that? Instead of just saying, thank you. But they wanted to understand. And you see the disciples do this on a regular basis. So Yeshua is saying, I know you're going to ask, so let me just tell you up front. Okay? So they said, well, when did we do this? When did we see you hungry and feed you and thirsty and give you drink and stranger and take you in and naked and clothe you, sick and, you know, and visited you and in prison, etc. When did we see all, when did that happen? And the king shall answer and say to him, truly I say to you, and as far as you've done it to the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. So it's an action-based, relational-based action, really, that he's looking at. And he shall then say to those on the left, go away from me, accursed ones, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his messengers. Because I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, you did not take me in. Naked and you did not clothe me. Sick in prison and you didn't visit me. Then they also shall answer him saying, Master, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or naked or sick or in prison and did not serve you? And he says the same thing. Truly I say to you, as far as you did not do it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you didn't do it to me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into everlasting life. So what we're going to see, again, well done, good and trustworthy servant, enter into the joy of the master. The joy of the master has to do with everlasting life. See, again, if you read the whole context, we can start to go, well, because what is the joy of the master? Well, he's telling you, those that had their lamps full, they're getting the everlasting life. Those that did not were going to get the punishment. Those who, you know, did something with the talents they were given were going to get the everlasting life. Those who didn't were going to get the punishment. And so we see this continually going on. You know, back in the beginning of the chapter, when it talked about, in verse 12, let's connect these dots properly. He says, but answering, he said, truly I say to you, I do not know you. I do not know you. Does that sound familiar? Like a verse that says, Master, Master. And he said, I do not know you. But we did all this stuff in your name. He said, yeah, but I didn't know you because you were working lawlessness, okay? And so that's really where we're kind of seeing that whole thing playing out here. It's the same thing. Remember, chapter 24, which by the way comes before chapter 25, talks about end time type of things and false messiahs and this idea of lawlessness increasing, okay? And people who think that, you know, we have a relationship when we don't. So he's trying to say, the relationship that gets you the everlasting life is one of doing my expectation. I expected you to feed me or my brethren, give drink or my brethren, okay? Visit, take care of, serve the brethren, because that's how you serve me. Because a lot of people say, oh, I just serve Messiah. by yourself doing nothing for anybody else? How does that really work? Because we're talking about being a good and trustworthy servant. Oh, yes, I serve Messiah. How? He doesn't need anything. But he wants you to be an extension, his arm. He wants you to be an extension of him. So through you, he can do. You're going to be arms and legs and, you know, strong back or whatever it is, or you're going to be a mouth and you're going to speak comforting words or whatever. You're going to extend from him. You can feed, you can give drink, you can visit, you can clothe. All right? Now, so we see here the context, which I think is really important now that we see that, is really understanding that this is about everlasting life versus punishment. And by the way, verse 46, let's not get too wound up on this. It's the punishment that's everlasting, not the punishing. In other words, you get to get in the kingdom, that's everlasting life. You don't, that's permanent. You don't get to get in. The punishment is permanent. Because remember, we do have a thing called resurrection, which means that even death is not permanent, potentially, right? But if you're not with your lamp full, or you're not doing something with the talents he's given you, okay, or if you're not a sheep extending from Yeshua to take care of people in a Yeshua-like manner, then you're going to not be entering into the everlasting life. See, you earn that. Okay, you earn that. And that's what he's trying to get the point across. Somehow Christians miss this all the time. Not Christians, the teachers of the Christians. The Christian teachers and pastors who are not understanding that you do earn the everlasting life. Now, you didn't do anything to create it to be available to even earn. That was Yeshua's death, burial, and resurrection made that possible. But whether or not you get it has to do with your lamp being full, or you're doing something with the talents and the way you treat the brothers. And this is what we're talking about. So you need to get, so some of you might say, okay, you read this verse, but now why did you read the whole 46 verses? Because that's where the context comes from, and this is in the middle of all that. So it's interesting. So when the virgins who have the oil, the lamps, and they're full, and the others are asking, and they say, well, go out there. The foolish one says, give me your oil. And the wise say, no, indeed, there would not be enough for us and for you. Instead, go to those who sell and buy for yourselves. Which really, there's no way to buy it. You have to go and do it. He's saying, I can't give you of my actions, of my merit. Let's put it that way. I can't give you the things I've done that merit. You have to merit for yourself. And if you don't merit, even what you have will be taken from you. That's part of the message that's here. So hopefully we're seeing this as it kind of builds this case, right? So you've got three parables here, all saying basically the same thing, all right? Really, I guess the last one could be the first one because it talks about some of the things you would do. But there's more to it. It's the relationship of Torah observance, the submission and trust to the instructions from above. And we're going to see that connected in more of these verses that have to do with the idea of being good, okay? Of being good. Because the first step in this is well done, good. Because you can do well done, evil. Or well done, you can do anything well. Some of you were very good at doing wrong things. Anybody? I certainly was, okay? So you can certainly do wrong things well, all right? So, you know, so it's basically saying as doing good well as opposed to doing something else well, okay? So it says, okay, you did good well. Congratulations. But what's good? Let's get more of that definition. Let's go now to Matthew 19, all right? Matthew 19 and verse 16, okay? And see, one came and said to him, good teacher, what good shall I do to have everlasting life? Okay, can we not see immediately, and by the way, this is previous to chapter 25, there's a connection between good and everlasting life. It's not just everlasting life, just believe in Yeshua. I mean, like that he exists and did whatever he did, right? Just believe that. No, there's good to be done here. Because he says very clearly, good teacher, what good shall I do to have everlasting life. And Yeshua said, you're an idiot. There's nothing to do. I die and I give you the whole thing and there's nothing more for you to do. No, he doesn't say that, does he? Because for all of you who are learning from Christianity's side of this, you do have to do. Instead of being told, oh no, if you try to do, you're making a mockery. No, not doing makes a mockery. You've been lied to in such big ways, I can't even begin. But just listen to the teachings that I do and hopefully you get some idea, all right? Good teacher, what good shall I do to have everlasting life? And he said to him, first of all, let's define good. He's not picking on the guy. He says, why do you call me good? No one is good except one, Elohim. So he's not saying I'm not good. He's trying to say whatever good I am is because I'm being like Elohim. Okay? So he's not saying only one is good and I'm not good. Only one is good, and if I'm like him, then I can also be good. But only because I'm like him. So when you behave like him, you're considered good. When you don't, you're not considered good. Okay? Now, so he said to him, why do you call me good? There's none but Elohim. But if you wish to enter into everlasting life, into life, he says, guard the Torah. Guard the commands. Oh, wait, Yeshua wanted him to guard the commands. Well, yeah, only for a little while until he died, then it went away. See how stupid that sounds? Okay? And you know why we believe that kind of nonsense? Because we don't want to do. So we want to believe that we don't have to. The lazy side of us doesn't want to have to do anything. He says, guard the commands. And he said to him, which? So, such a typical human thing. I get this on a regular basis, by the way, from quote-unquote New Testament Christian people that are trying to figure out how the Torah fits into their life as they're becoming more messianic and less Christian. And they ask a question like, well, I've been asked this a lot. How much of the Old Testament flowed through into the New? All of it. What do you mean? All of it. Nothing was done away with. It all is still valid and in play. Nothing has changed. I am Yahweh, I change not, right? Okay? Now, so this is what the same, so this guy goes, well, which ones? Well, clearly the attitude was wrong. Because now he's doing what a lot of you do. What's the least that I have to do is what he's asking. Now, he wasn't asking if I have to do commandments. He was just told he needed to. So he's like, well, which ones? Because I only want to do the ones I have to do. I don't know. He could have said, remember Sinai when he said, if you agree to do everything I say? That's it right there. Do everything he says. That's the covenant. Do everything. It's all still valid. Now, there are some things, let's be clear, that you can't do because there are things you need to be in place to do them. So to do them would be wrong now. You can't do the things that we needed a temple for without a temple. So you can't do them, all right? Certain things were jurisdictional. Like you can't do certain things in terms of like stoning people without being in the land with a judicial system that is scriptural judicial system to apply those laws. So you can't just go out there and stone somebody. Okay? Because people always like to say, oh, so you're keeping the law now. What, are you going to start stoning people? I usually say, yeah, it's a good idea. Let's start with you. Anyway, because they're so being wise, you know, wise rear ends. We'll put that out there, right? Because they're just doing that. All right? And I'm just like, you deserve a dumb answer. Okay? Because you're being a whatever. Okay? Sounds like answer. You're being a dumb almost answer. Okay. So, look. But I say no. I said it would be breaking the law for me to stone anybody at this point. Okay? Because I wouldn't have what the law requires to stone somebody. It requires very specific jurisdictional stuff. Okay? And if you're not in the same, if the jurisdiction is not right, you got to be in a certain place with certain authorities in place and everybody cohesively in the land as a nation. You can't just do this wherever you are scattered. Okay? So no, we don't do everything that was out of the mouth of Yahweh, because some of it would be wrong for us to do now. Wrong meaning we don't have the right things in place to do them. All right? Just like it would be wrong for you to do something of a priest if you weren't a priest. There are things that you do because it's for you to do in the right context, okay? So none of the law was ever done away with. Some of it is no longer doable because we're scattered. And we need to be in the land to do it. We need to have a temple to do it. We need a priesthood to do it. So we don't have that at the moment. By the way, we'll have that again. And when we do, guess what? All that stuff will come back into play. All right? Now, so when people say, oh, the 613 commands, well, you can wipe out a good couple of hundred of them just with the fact that there's no temple. So you got a lot less to focus on. Okay? Now, so he says, so which ones? Which ones? This is, again, the attitude. Okay? Don't you fall into this. Because I know people, when they first get new with this, like, well, what do I need to do really to keep the Sabbath? What's the least I have to do? Be a maximalist. Okay? Don't be looking for the very minimum 24.00 hours for Sabbath. Okay? I start early, I end late, I make sure the Sabbath is covered. Simple. All right? I'm not going to go outside and be like, well, it's not like quite dark yet, so I'm going to keep going. No, it's close enough. I'm going to start early and make sure. And I'm not stopping until it's dark. I mean, it's sun is, now, my phone might tell me sundown is at 6:50, and I go outside and it's like light outside. Because just because the sun dropped below the horizon doesn't make it dark. So I'm going to wait till it's dark. Then I'll finish my Sabbath. Okay? So he said to him, which? And Yeshua said, well, the Ten Commandments, right? He says, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, respect your father and your mother, love your neighbor as yourself, which, by the way, is an Old Testament idea. For those of you who need to know where it is, it's in Leviticus, 18 or 19, right? 19:18, okay? Okay, so, okay, just so that you have that verse. Right, it's at the end of the verse, 19:18, it says, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Not a New Testament idea. So Yeshua is quoting from the commandments. So he only names a few. Oh, so those are the only ones we have to do. No, he's just giving the guy an idea. Look, you got to keep the commandments. All right? And the young man said to him, all these I've watched over from my youth. What do I still lack? Now, by the way, isn't it interesting that he realized he lacked something? Something in him knew that he was lacking. Okay? And Yeshua said to him, well, if you wish to be perfect, tamim, filled with integrity, complete, whole, he says, then go, sell what you have and give it to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and then come and follow me. Now, let's take the middle part out of there. If you wish to be perfect, come and follow me. That's the answer for everybody. His particular problem was that he had a problem with stuff. He liked stuff. So Yeshua threw that little piece in the middle there for him personally. So it's not a commandment for all of us to sell everything and be impoverished monks or whatever, you know, with a vow of poverty. Because it says in the next verse, it says, and the young man heard the word and went away sad because he had a lot of stuff. That wasn't just that he had a lot of stuff. He was emotionally attached to his stuff. Okay? If you're not attached to your stuff, you would just give it away. If you needed to give it away. If the person, like it says, if they wanted your garment, you give them also the other garment too. Okay? Because you're not attached to it. So you have to be careful with that. All right? Now, and I, you know what? I applied this one time. I remember I've told this story before. It used to be years ago that we sold shofars. Okay, we had shofars we sold. And I had mine that I carried around with me when I traveled. And I was visiting with a congregation. And the person that was leading the congregation said, hey, this congregation needs a nice shofar. I said, great. I got about four left in the car. You can pick whatever one you want. And the person was like, no, I want that one. That was mine. And I was like, but that's mine. But then I remembered this, and I said, so what? I'll get a different one. It doesn't matter that it's mine. It's the one you want. You want a great one for your congregation. I think it's a great horn, and it really was. So sure, you can take that one. Okay. Now, of course, you purchased it because we were selling them at the time. What I'm just saying is, it didn't matter that it was mine, though. And I can tell you, as a younger person, I had a real problem with my stuff. I was very possessive of my stuff. I didn't share well with anybody, didn't give things to anybody. I had to learn to force myself, really is how it started, to make myself be generous and to give away things and give away things. And that little part of me popped up right when I was asked for that horn. Hey, that's mine. Then the other part of me said, no, we learned this lesson a long time ago. There isn't anything that's mine that I need to worry about. Okay? I also had a leather version of the scriptures, 1998. It had my name in the front of it in little stickers that my wife had put in there. Okay? Sort of a female blue thing, right? Put your name in like little cute stickers. All right? And the person said, well, I also want a leather Bible. I said, well, I don't have any at the moment. I just got one. It's mine. And then she said, oh, can I get that one? I said, sure. Because again, didn't matter, right? Okay? Now, I do like this version, the 98 version. I mean, most of you guys use the 2009. And so what Abba's given me over the years, people have given me 98 versions of it. Not leather ones, but you know, the blue hardcovers. So I have ones as I wear them out. I've got copies. That's all I need. It doesn't matter if it's the leather one, you know? Okay? And so can we get to that place where we're not emotionally entwined with and attached to our stuff? Okay? Because guess what? When you die, you don't take it with you. When you're resurrected, you're not going to need any of it. Okay? So why are we attached to stuff? And we do. We get very emotional about our stuff. And so this person, I'm guessing, is pretty obvious. Even Christianity teaches you had an emotional problem with stuff. Possessions. Okay? But let's just look at that verse again. He says, if you wish to be perfect, again, I don't think it means like literally perfect, but whole, complete, with integrity, come and follow me. So, but the person had a challenge to come and follow him because of this love of stuff. You know, we have in the Vahafta, which is right after the Shema in Deuteronomy 6, it says, and you shall love Yahweh your Elohim with all. You can't do that if you love your stuff more than you love him. You love your stuff on the same level even, whatever, as if this love of stuff can really get you in trouble. We do have that. I've known a few people that had a real problem with like their love of their car or their love of some other thing that they owned, okay? That was their whole focus. That was their joy and their obsession. Be obsessed with him and that's it. Okay? You can enjoy everything else. No reason. He wants you to have possessions, but he doesn't want you to put them as the highest priority. And so then Yeshua says, again, I say, well, he says to his taught ones, because he's trying to explain what's going on with these guys, with this guy in this question. He said, truly I say to you that it's hard for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of the heavens. It's hard. Because a rich man is going to have what problems? Rich man is already going to feel like he has mostly. When do we normally look up when we're struggling? When we don't have, when we're on our back. That's kind of why he likes to sweep your legs out so you can get on your back and look up. Okay, let's life knock the legs out from under you. A rich man doesn't feel that need. Okay? Look, I've done a lot of things in my life, and I was really successful at some of them. I could have been a very wealthy person not doing this, right? I could have been very wealthy out there doing secular things. And Abba sort of crashed almost all of them in very interesting and bizarre ways. And I think the reason is because had those things kept going, I would not have been looking to do this or do anything this way because I would have been content in my riches. So he never let me get there. Or at least if I got there for a few minutes, he took it away. Okay? And so just realize that there's a benefit to some level of poverty and struggle. Not that you should want to be impoverished. We're not talking about that. But just the idea that you have to be careful that when you do get abundance, that you don't let it derail where you're going. Because it's hard for a rich person to get in. Why? Because a rich person is going to not do all the things that are necessary because they're going to have contentment that everything's great. So why do I need to do anything? All right? Now, he says, again, I say to you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man enter into the reign of Elohim. So there is, and I believe this is what he's talking about. It's not just picturing this little eye of a needle. There is actually a rock formation in the land called the eye of the needle. And when you would go down the path that would pass through this very tight rock formation, you would have to unload all the burdens off your camel to go through, because the packs and the animal and everything couldn't just go through. So, in other words, you have to unburden all of that stuff to get through. Let's go to, he says, and when the tall ones heard this, verse 25, they were astonished, saying, well, then who is able to be saved? Now, they're connecting saved with kingdom entrance. But remember, kingdom entrance then and salvation is being linked by Yeshua to works. Don't miss that point. Everything he's been saying to this man who asked the question is things to do. What do I need to do? He didn't say nothing, just believe in me. Okay? He said, do these things and come and follow me. Be in the same way I am. Do what I do. Go listen to the follow the pattern exactly teaching, where we talk about that whole idea of following. Come and follow me. So now his disciples are like, well, then who's able to have this everlasting life? What salvation is making available to you? And then Yeshua says, you're looking intently, Yeshua said to them, with man this is impossible, with Elohim all is possible. Now, let's not read that wrong. It doesn't mean you should do nothing, Elohim's got to do it for you. It means if you're trying to do it your way, on your smarts and your wisdom and the fleshly stuff, you can't get there. But if you trust in him and do it his way, then certainly it's possible. All things are possible. But you have to do it that way. You can't just do it your way. Your way doesn't lead to this. All right? And Kepha answering said to him, see, we have left all and followed you, which is what he told the young man to do. What then shall we have? In other words, so what do we get? We've done what you said here. And Yeshua said to them, truly I say to you, when the Son of Adam sits on the throne of his esteem, you who have followed me in the rebirth shall sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses, brothers and sisters, father or mother, or wife or children, or lands, for my authority, my name's sake, shall receive 100-fold and shall inherit everlasting life. Oh, so you have to do very challenging things. Then you inherit everlasting life. I want to encourage you. Look, a lot of you are really struggling with family members, friends, and other people that are giving you a lot of grief for your choice to do this. Guess what? That's okay. He says, anyone who has left houses, some of you need to move. You might have to leave a house to move here or to move wherever he wants to move you, right? He says, or brothers and sisters, father and mother, wife and children, whatever, lands. You may lose a bunch of stuff because of your choice to follow him for his authority's sake. Look, are we going to understand what it says or not? I don't mean that. Are we going to receive what it says or not? We understand it, but do you want to receive it? Revelation. Revealed information. Let's call revelation what it is. It's revealed information. It's only information if it's not received and embraced as truth. And then you have to act upon it. Okay? And he's telling you that this is hard to do. If you're rich, by the way, you know what? You could be rich in relationships and then you won't do what you need to do. You could be rich in a lot of different ways and it's not even financial. Then you're not going to do what you need to do. So he's now taking it to from the wealthy man who's actually physically wealthy to people that are dealing with emotional challenges. I don't want to lose my kids or leave my kids. I don't want to deal with losing my parents. I don't want to move from my house in my very comfortable place I am wherever you live. He says, look, if you've left these things for my name's sake, for the authority that I represent, for you're making a stand to embrace that and following him, then you may need to go wherever he's sending you. He says, then you'll receive 100-fold and inherit everlasting life. That's very powerful stuff. And so let's kind of keep that in mind as we're going through this, okay? He's trying to show you when he says, well done, enter into the joy. So this is now giving you more of an understanding that the joy is everlasting life, and how we get to everlasting life is by doing good, because it's well done good. And here we're told that good is only the Father. And then what good can I do? Do what the Father said. That's the things that are good. So if you want to hear the words, well done, good and trustworthy servant, to be the good and trustworthy servant, then you have to understand what good is and do it. Because it's well done. For what is well done? The good. You well done doing the good. And being trustworthy, we'll deal with that eventually. And then being a servant. It's not one of the three or two of the three, it's all three. You have to do good. You got to be trustworthy. So you can't just do good occasionally, but trustworthy in your doing good. And you have to be a servant of the Most High. And you do that by also serving the brothers. And so we're going to kind of keep going through that as we go through this. So, again, please don't let whatever Christianese got in your head, okay? This verse is powerful when he says, what good shall I do to have everlasting life? And he tells them, keep commandments. Oh, but he didn't mention the Sabbath. They were all keeping the Sabbath. Okay, that's the community he was talking to, all right? This is more how you treat each other, he was talking about here, okay? I want you to not murder them, commit adultery with them, or steal from them, or bear false witness against them. Then he talks about how you treat parents. He says, I want you to honor mother and father. Respect them. Love your neighbor as yourself. So all of this is about how we treat others, which goes back to the sheep and the goats, which is in the same chapter 25 that the parable of the talents is, which is where we get the well done, right? And so just understand all that. And why do I want to make a joke all of a sudden that's why I like my steak well done? But anyway, for all you guys who like it rare. All right, never mind. But you want to do it well, all right? You want to be told you did the good well. Let's rearrange the words a little bit, right? That's what you're being praised for, doing good well. Being trustworthy in doing good well. Serving while doing good well. And that's what he says then, enter into the everlasting life. Enter into the joy of the master. Because clearly, the parable before and after are talking about everlasting life. The virgin's one is talking about it, and so is the sheep and the goats. So clearly, the one in the middle is talking about the same thing. He just happens to say, enter into the joy. All right? Context, which is why we had to read 46 verses to understand that in that chapter. Then we go now to 19, which we did, and we see that he talks about good as being commandment keeping. I don't see how you can argue that. Of course, the church does it every week, but it's right there. Oh, well, that was before he died. He doesn't change. Don't we have verses that say Messiah the same yesterday, today, and forever? Right? Doesn't change. All right, now, let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 10. You should know what verse we're going to here. All right. Good job, Maisie. She said verse 12. So Deuteronomy 10. And now Israel. We're just going to read two verses here. And now Israel, what is it Yahweh your Elohim is asking of you? Isn't that kind of what the young man was asking Yeshua? What do I need to do? So Israel, as they're about to cross the Jordan, is, you know, Moses knows that they have this question. He says, okay, so now Israel, what does Yahweh want from you? And he says, he's asking of you to fear him, to fear Yahweh your Elohim. So go listen to the Fear of Yahweh teaching. Understand that it's a deep, abiding reverence and awe for him, okay? He says, that's step one. And I believe, it doesn't say it this way, I believe this is a process. It's a formula. Step one, have a fear, awe, and reverence for the one who created everything. Because if you don't have that, you're not going to do anything else anyway. Or at least you're not going to do it right and with the right effort. Be all sloppy about it, okay? See, I think that that's where we still get into the, well, you know, it's good enough. Well, only if he says it's good enough. It's not good enough because you think so. And I would be afraid to just decide for yourself what's good enough. That's where you go and get counsel with someone who actually speaks on his behalf. That's where the anointed, appointed people come in. And don't get all like, oh, you're so presumptive to think that you speak. I don't think anything. He does say there are people that do it. You need to find them that you believe are actually speaking on his behalf, his word, with authority, Deuteronomy 17 type stuff. All right? Let's kind of make sure we're clear on that. Okay? Now, so step one, we fear him. Step two, we walk in all his ways. So you do everything that he does. Yeshua said, come and follow me. Walk as I walk. So walking is an action, right? It's doing. He didn't say, step one, fear him. Step two, just believe in him. But if you don't believe and have reverence for him, then why would you walk in his ways or do anything? So the whole thing is belief is an action, okay? James says the same thing, right? I'll show you my belief by my actions. I don't have to tell you what I believe. You just watch me. You'll know what I believe. Belief in action. Now, so in walking in all his ways, guess what? We realize that he loves us. Because in walking in his ways, you realize they work. I've said that they do three things. They bless you. They keep you safe. I mean, look, if somebody's not stealing from you and murdering you and false witnessing against you and committing adultery against you and paying you a fair day's wage for fair days and, you know, work and not using unequal measures, I mean, you're safer, right? And the last part is when you do what he says, it transforms you over time into what he is. You become more like him. What made Yeshua so much like the Father when he said, look, you see me, you see the Father, because everything he said, everything I do is what the Father does, and everything I say is what he says. So it's like you're seeing him. We should become that as well. If people see you, they should see him. Okay? It's a hard thing to do, though, because you got to get you out of the way. And that's the tough part. And we're going to talk about that quite a bit when we deal with some of the verses in Romans and other places that we're going to go to. Okay? Now, so step one, fear him. Step two, walk in his ways. We realize that he loves us, and guess what we do in response to that? We respond by loving him. Christianity wants you to have this emotional love for him first. Why would we start there? You know, a lot of you did that when you were a kid. You fell in love with somebody. It was like this, you know, infatuation thing, and you didn't even hardly know the person. But you just got starstruck or love struck or whatever they call it, right? And then you got to know them and realized that wasn't what I thought they were. And that's not what I, but you're so, you know, rose-colored glasses and the whole thing. He wants us to fall in love with him. Step three. First, recognize he's the awesome king of the universe who created everything, who could zap you in a heartbeat and give you anything he wants to give you or wipe it all out. Have reverence for his awesome power and majesty and everything else. Number two, show him some trust and do what he says, recognizing that he's the authority. And then see that it works. I mean, can we all agree that when you started doing this, you started to notice a change in your life, that it works? Otherwise, why would you do it? I mean, if it didn't work, you wouldn't do it. Okay? You could try it. It didn't work. So why would you do it? I haven't had anybody who actually did it for a period of time have it not work. He says it does, and it does. That's part of what he says here in Deuteronomy 10:12. Then we actually have a proper love for him. It's a response to his love. Okay? It's a response. Some of you fall in love with people as you have a relationship with them and they start taking care of you in a certain way and they're there for you in a certain way, even if a friendship love, right? Because you realize that they're genuine and who they are and you get that, right? So then, even though you might not have liked them so much or just were more neutral at the beginning, but you start to actually fall in love with them. Even though they may have things that irritate the whatever out of you, But you realize through the relationship that you're now responding to the love they show you in whatever way they show it to you. Okay? Because you're realizing they do love you. So when we realize he loves us, he didn't just make us, we respond by falling in love with him. All right, now the next step. He says, and to serve Yahweh your Elohim with all your heart, with all your being. Oh, so after we fall in love with him, the desire is then to serve, which again, we're dealing with the good and trustworthy servant. So I'm going to lay out in advance here, I'm sure we'll cover it again when we get to servant, that this servant fears Yahweh, walks in all his ways, and loves him. So I'm sure we're going to use this verse again. Okay, now, verse 13. And I have no idea why the ISR put a question mark at the end of this. There are no question marks in Hebrew. Okay? I think it's one of those things that irritates me in this translation. Verse 13 says, you are to serve Yahweh with all your heart and with all your being, to guard the commands of Yahweh, which is what Yeshua just told the young man, and his laws, which I command you today for your good. These things are for your good. And by the way, there's no question about that, so I have no idea why these people put that there, okay? It's a statement. He's saying, this is the expectation of Yahweh, that you fear him, walk in his ways, love him, and serve him with everything you've got, guard his commands and his laws, which I command you today, because they're for your good. So go back to the idea of what is good? The laws and the commands. So when he says, well done, good, that means you're doing this, because these things are the definition that he uses for what is good. None are good but Elohim, and Elohim gives you his laws, his right rulings, his commandments, and they are good. Okay? Now, go to chapter 6. We'll stay in Deuteronomy. We're going to get more done today than I thought we would. All right, chapter 6 and verse 24. Yahweh commanded us to do all these laws, to fear Yahweh or Elohim for our good always, to keep us alive as it is today. Yahweh commanded us something that's for our good always. So what did he command us that's good? Well, to do all his laws and to fear him, because doing that is good. That's the good thing to do by his definition of good. Okay? And he says, and it is righteousness. Okay, let's make sure we understand what righteousness is now. This is not like just reading that one verse where Abraham, it was, you know, accounted for him for righteousness, and we don't know what that means because we think he did nothing. Well, that's not true. He did a lot of things that showed he had action to show he was righteous, doing what was right. Here, it says righteousness definition is, it is righteousness for us when we guard to do all his command. And we do it before. In other words, we do it where he sees us. We do it in front of him. We are living in front of him where he can watch us, and we're guarding and doing all his commands. This is right. Righteousness merely just means you're doing what is right. Okay? But right according to Yahweh. So we do this before Yahweh Elohim as he commanded us. So when we do what he said, which is back to Exodus 19, the agreement, the covenant, which is if you do what I say, I will give you all these other things. If you agree to do everything I say. But you got to agree, and then you have to do it. Go listen to the Are You Covenanted series a few more times. I know it's 55 parts, but it's worth listening to a couple of times. Okay? Stay here in go to Luke. We're going to go now to Luke chapter 6. All right? Luke chapter 6 and in verse 45. Okay? And then I'm going to read you the one verse, and then we're going to go back and get the context like we did in chapter 25 of Matthew. The good man, okay, now we have that sort of right, good servant, good man, brings forth what is good out of the treasure of his heart. The wicked man brings forth what is wicked out of the wicked treasure of his heart. For out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. Okay, so that's verse 45. So let's drop back to verse 31 for context. Okay, verse 31 for context. And as you wish men should do to you, you should also do to them the same way. If you love those loving you, what favor have you? For sinners too love those loving them. And if you do good to those doing good to you, what favor have you? For even sinners do the same. Now, just so we're clear on the grace issue, this is the only place Yeshua mentions grace. Does it sound like a doctrine to you? Does it even sound like it's unmerited? He says, if you only do good things and merit, with people that merit favor with you, then why would it merit favor to you? How would it merit anything for you? If you only love those loving you, what merit is there in that? Does that sound like unmerited? Of course. Well, he's trying to say, really, you want to say that it merits you something when you're only doing that to people that do nice to you? If you only love those loving you, how does that merit anything? If you only do good to those doing good to you, how does that merit anything? So that clearly is not talking about a doctrine. And this is the only place Yeshua mentions grace. In this gospel. No place else. So for all you Christians who think grace is the whole thing, why didn't Yeshua ever talk about it? Okay? He didn't talk about it. This is the only place, and it's not even talking about anything that you normally think grace is. It's not talking about somebody that's all screwed up and they're going to receive favor even though they don't deserve it. This is literally saying, if you do what's easy and expected to do, why do you expect any credit for that? It's easy to love somebody who loves you. It's easy to do good to somebody who does good to you. That doesn't get you any credit for that. You don't score any points for that, is what he's saying. Oh, no, grace isn't about scoring points. Yes, it is. Go listen to the teaching. This is literally that same word. Go in your King James. It says grace here. Okay? Here it says favor in the ISR, but it'll say grace in your other translations. What grace is it? Okay? It's the same word, charis, in the Greek. All right? Now, continuing here, he says, and if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive back, what favor does that get you? That's scoring you a whole bunch of points? For even sinners lend to sinners to receive back as much. Those are the only three mentions of the word by Yeshua. Rather, love your enemies, do good and lend, expecting none in return. Your reward shall be great, and you shall be sons of the Most High, because he is kind to the thankless and wicked ones. Therefore, be compassionate as your Father is also compassionate. Do not judge, and you shall not be judged at all. Condemn not, and you shall not be condemned at all. Forgive, and you shall be forgiven. This sounds like a lot of work, right? Give, and it shall be given to you. A good measure, pressed down and shaken together, running over, shall be put into your lap. For with the same measure with which you measure, it shall be measured back to you. And he spoke a parable to them. Is a blind able to lead a blind? Shall they not both fall in a pit? A taught one is not above his teacher, but everyone perfected shall be like his teacher. So look at the context of all that's going on here. He said the good man brings forth out of the good that's in his heart, the wicked man out of the wicked that's in his heart. And now we're seeing his definition of good and also of wicked. He says, well, look, this is what, doesn't a good man, he's going to do these things. He's not going to judge. He's not going to condemn. He's going to give and have it be given to him and all those kind of things. He's going to use the same measure that it comes out, the measure we receive back. You shall reap what you sow. I didn't put that verse in here, but you guys all know that verse. Elohim is not mocked, but you're going to reap what you sow. He says, and he spoke a parable, is not a blind able to lead a blind? I mean, is a blind able to lead a blind? Shall they not both fall in a pit? Think about who you're learning from, because you may end up in a pit, because some of these people out there with microphones are blind. He says, a taught one is not above his teacher, but everyone perfected shall be like his teacher. A taught one is not above his teacher. So, no, none of us are above Yeshua. Yeshua is not above the Father who taught Yeshua. And if I am your teacher, let's deal with that ego problem where you want to start going above me. A taught one is not above his teacher. You better have that ego, pride, and arrogance that is talked about in other parts of Deuteronomy, especially in check. Especially all you guys who want to get online now and start typing in the chat. It can't right now. It's shut down. But when it's open, are you going to call here and want to straighten me out? Well, first, obviously, if you're trying to do that, I'm not your teacher. And if I'm not your teacher, why do you care what I say? If I'm not your teacher, why do you care what I say? Well, I'm the sword of the Almighty and I have to straighten you out. Nonsense. Okay? That is complete and utter nonsense. None of you has that job. So just knock that off. You want to get a microphone and record something? Good. Post it. Maybe somebody will listen to it. But it's not your job. I call no ministries up to straighten them out. None. I don't know why you guys do it. I sit there trying to patiently listen to the nonsense. I usually end up hanging up at some point because nobody's listening to me on the other side of the phone. But where do you get that nerve from, that disrespect from, that arrogance from? Yeshua says, very clearly, a taught one is not above his teacher, but everyone perfected shall be like his teacher. That's called discipleship. Okay, discipleship is you becoming like your teacher. So when Paul and the other apostles were out there doing, people that they were discipling were learning to be like Peter, like James, whoever their teacher was, like Paul, who was imitating their teacher, Yeshua, who was imitating his teacher, the Father. Okay? So if I'm your teacher, especially if you think that you want to teach someday, you better figure out how to sound like me. Okay? I don't mean personality-wise, information-wise, the message. Because if you read the four Gospels, they have a very, very different tone with the same message. Okay? The writers are not giving the same tone in the way the information is expressed when you read the various Gospels. So you read Matthew and you read John, they sound very different. Okay? So that being said, continuing, he says here, why do you see the splinter in your brother's eye but not aware of the plank in your own? Because he's trying to say, look, you have hypocrisy. You think that, you know, whatever you say, whatever comes out of you, you got to understand where it's coming from. You can't have good come out of you unless there's good in you. So why don't you work on you? He says, why do you see the splinter in your brother's eye but not aware of the plank in your own? Or how are you able to say to your brother, brother, let me get the splinter out of your, that is in your eye, not seeing the plank in your own eye. Hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, then you shall clearly see to take the splinter that's in your brother's eye. For a good tree, now we're going to see, here's the context. He gave all of that to say, because a good tree is not able to yield rotten fruit, nor does a rotten tree yield good fruit. So he's saying, if you're busy working on your brother and not on yourself, you're not qualified to work on your brother. Focus on you. Get that plank out of your own eye. Which, by the way, I think he understood, and we should understand, should keep you busy enough to never bother with your brother splinter. Okay? Because when you start working on the plank in your eye, you certainly, at some point, if you're openly, like, really honest, you'll recognize that there's a lumberyard there. Okay? There's not just one plank. Okay? There's like, you know, you pull the plank out and boom, there's another one. Okay? Just sitting behind it, ready to pop out for you to work on. There's a whole giant lumberyard full of it. Keep you plenty busy. Because remember, he said, judge not, condemn not. So all of this is about you work on you. Okay? He says, for each tree is known by its own fruit. Verse 44, for they do not gather figs from thorns, nor do they gather grapes from a bramble bush. The good man brings forth what is good out of the good treasure of his heart. Now you see the context? So all of this is still talking about how you treat others and how you treat our Creator. It's all the same problem. Okay? So the good man brings forth what's good out of the good treasure of his heart. The wicked man forth what is out of the wicked treasures in his heart. And then he goes in verse, let's see how far did I want to go with this, all the way to the end. So in verse 46, but why do you call me master, master, and do not do what I say? You know what? Go home and meditate on that verse and look at your life and say, am I doing what he says? I call him master, master, don't you? Yeshua is my Messiah. He's my master. He's my soon coming king, but you don't do what he says. And of course, all you guys who are watching who are Christians, he said everything that thus said Yahweh in the Old Testament. So don't just focus on what he said from Matthew to Revelation. Okay? He's the one on the mountain giving the law. Just understand that. And I'm not doing a oneness doctrine that the Father is the Son, okay? The Father's always been on the outside looking in, and he sent his Son to do all the work here in the form that he interacted with Israel in the Old Testament, Abraham, as we're going to see, having lunch with him in the next Torah portion in Genesis 18. That's the Son. Okay, the Father has not come here. The Father and Son together in Genesis 1, go listen to Do You Know the Father and the Son. Okay, in Genesis 1, they worked together to start everything. Once there was life, death, sin, possible, all those things, the Son handled everything from there forward, all the way to Revelation 21. Then the Father and Son together are back when there's no more sin, no more death. There's a protocol the Father has that he's not going to be here interacting with God. He's going to let his Son do the work, but he's still in charge. And the Son says, I only do what the Father tells me to do. I only say what he tells me to say. Don't confuse all that, right? He says, why do you call me Master, Master? Don't do what I say. Everyone who is coming to me and is hearing my words and is doing them, I shall show him what are you going to be like? I will show you whom he will like, who he's like. He's like a man building a house who dug deep and laid a foundation on the rock. And when a flood came and the stream burst against the house, it was unable to shake it, for it was founded on the rock. See, now picture it again. He's trying to connect now. Why do you call me Master, Master, and don't do what I say? It's because you're not founded on a rock. You're not digging deep. You don't have a strong foundation. So you get easily blown over. By the way, this is going to also get us into eventually the parable of the sower and the seed. We're not going to cover that at this point. It'll probably be next, okay? Because after all, we're not talking about trees and good fruit and all that kind of stuff. We're going to get to chapter 13 next, okay? Well, we got something between this and next. But we're going to get there, all right? But you see how that's kind of pointing those directions. So he says, why don't you do what I say? Well, there's a reason. If you don't have the foundation, you can get blown out. And we're going to read again another picture, a metaphor, a parable of that, if you're not in good ground. How the cares of the world or somebody just saying boo could scare you away from all this. Oh, you're in a cult. Boom, you're out of here. Well, if you've got a strong foundation, you know that they're wrong and you know how to deal with it. And what they say doesn't affect you, doesn't influence you. He says, but the one hearing and not doing. So he's connecting back to verse 47, right? He says, you call me, on verse 46, he says, you call me Master, Master, but you don't do. So if you're hearing and doing, guess what that does? It lays a solid foundation. Deuteronomy 10:12, because you're fearing him, you're walking in his ways, and you're loving him and serving him, guess what? Nobody can shake your tree. Nobody can knock down your house. The big bad wolf can huff and puff and nothing's going to happen. But if you're not doing, then you're not learning to fear him. Then you're not building what you learn about his love for you because you're not walking in his ways. So then you're not loving him properly. You're not serving him properly. And so, sure, you're weak enough to get knocked out. He says, the one hearing and not doing is like a man who built his house on earth without a foundation, against which the stream burst and immediately it fell, and the ruin of that house was great. So notice, the foundation is what? The hearing and doing creates a foundation. Hearing and not doing, you got a house, but you don't have a foundation. So that's where you get to, again, to hear the good doing well of the doing well of the good, right? Good for you, you're doing well doing good, right? Well done. Doing good. You're hearing and doing because good is what he says to do. See how that's connecting up? Oh, we're laying that in there really well here. The next one, we don't have time for. All right, so, because I'm going to read like 29 verses. And we're not going to go there. All right, so this is just the beginning. I hope you understand that we're now laying a much more solid and deep foundation from the original teaching, which was like over 12 years ago. Actually, the original teaching was back in 1999 or 2000, something like that. So it was a long time ago. That one's not available anywhere. It was on tape before the internet was really where everybody put everything. So hopefully we're going to really dig into this. I want you to look for you in this reality. Are you the young man trying to figure out what's the least you have to do? Are you the one saying, Master, Master, but not doing? Are you the one who's got a lamp without oil in it because you haven't done the things to fill the oil. The oil is not going out and getting spirit to put in it. The oil is your merited works. The works that merit favor fill your lamp. You understand that now? Because that's the consistency of chapter 25 of Matthew. It's showing a pattern that all those parables are saying the same thing. To be in the kingdom, to be welcomed in, you have to have a lamp filled with good works. Okay? Not saying that you just have to do some good things. No, you have to be a person who out of the abundance of your heart, the good comes out because you're filled with good. And that good is only Him. He is all of that, right? All right, let's go to the Father. Father, we want to come before You. And Father, we want to hear You say that we are good and trustworthy servants, that we should enter into the everlasting life to be with You forever. And Father, we are learning to understand what that looks like in terms of dealing with our planks in our eyes, dealing with understanding that we may have our hearts aimed in the wrong direction before our love may be divided instead of focused on You. And that, Father, we should truly be embracing the pattern of fearing You and then walking in Your ways, loving You and serving You. So, Father, help us to truly receive the revelation that You're giving us today and that we then would apply it to bear fruit, to yield good fruit. So, Father, we want to thank You. We want to praise You. We want to give You all glory and honor in the name above all names, Yeshua, our Messiah. Amen. 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 All right.